I'm Amanda Armstrong, and the title of the paper is not what it says in the program, but is Real Subsumption, Violence, and Struggles at the Limits of Reproduction around 1970. Okay, thank you. And I guess the paper broadly is like comes out of a materialist feminist project, and I talk a little bit about organizing around railway work and railway injuries in the first section of the paper, and that's kind of what my dissertation is on, so, yeah. Oh, should I actually go?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I think that, because otherwise people will forget.
Cool, okay. In 1873, British railway companies experienced a sharp drop in profits, part of a broader crisis of profitability in the capitalist system. Management responded by imposing forms of speed-up specific to the railway industry, forcing longer hours on workers and running trains more frequently on existing tracks. Predictably, these measures brought about a significant increase in workplace injuries and deaths on the rails. It was in this context that rail workers in England and Wales established the first lasting national railway trade union and initiated a series of wildcat strikes, informal seizures of company property, and demonstrations demanding higher pay, reduced hours, and the legal standing to sue for compensation following workplace injury or death. The union also established and maintained a death fund for its members, which, despite regular protests by those denied benefits, only dispersed money to legal widows of killed railway workers who both remained single and were still caring for young children. In 1970, nearly a century later, U.S. airline companies experienced net losses after having maintained relatively high rates of profit through much of the 1960s. The crisis of profitability in the airline industry that began in 1970, part of a systemic crisis of profitability, has remained essentially unresolved since, having been exacerbated by industry-wide deregulation in 1978. In 1971, airline managers responded to the previous year's losses by spending more on advertising and marketing, particularly on advertising that sexualized flight attendants. National Airlines required all flight attendants to wear Fly Me buttons, while Continental introduced the slogan, "We really move our tails for you." These advertising campaigns prompted a group of stewardesses working with national feminist organizations to publicly contest the normalization of sexual harassment on the planes. In response to the Fly Me buttons, for example, flight attendants affiliated with Stewardesses for Women's Rights made and wore Go Fly Yourself buttons. This effort was part of a broader wave of feminist organizing in the early 1970s against workplace sexual harassment, domestic abuse, and rape, forms of traumatizing patriarchal violence that work to confine and control women and gender-variant people within and across particular sites of labor, both waged and unwaged. In juxtaposing these two sites of class struggle, the British railways of the 1870s and the US railways of the 1970s, it is possible to show not only their formal continuities, but also the significant discontinuities between these moments and sites of struggle. At least according to the stories I've presented, each of these situations is characterized by a formally similar sequence of events. First, there is an industry-wide crisis of profitability, then a management offensive, and then a wave of refusal on the part of workers. In both cases, workers rebelled not only against overwork and inadequate pay, but also against management attempts to exacerbate their exposure to particular forms of workplace injury or violence. If we consider these moments of class struggle through a somewhat broader lens, though, critical distinctions come into focus. First, these sequences of struggle contributed to diametrically opposed transformations of metropolitan gender and family forms. On the one hand, antagonisms between British railway workers and owners in the 1870s were conditioned by and contributed to the increasing dependence of proletarianized women upon wages earned by men. As Eric Hobsbawm notes, in 1851, three-quarters of married women had been engaged in some form of waged employment. In 1913, only 10% were employed. Railway trade unionists themselves reproduced not only this intensifying condition of dependence, but also the devaluation of women's lives and non-procreative abilities as they discouraged the employment of women in the railway industry, and they established provident funds to be paid to widows that tied benefit payments following a husband's accident-induced death to each widow's marriage status and parenting activity. The struggle of flight attendants in the 1970s against sexual harassment, on the other hand, took shape at a moment when certain dimensions of compulsory heterosexuality and the patriarchy of the wage were being effectively contested. Late 20th century transformations in metropolitan gender and family forms have been overdetermined and have remained somewhat ambiguous, but it is possible to ascribe what changes have occurred to four main forces in the mid-20th century, or among four, among many others, I guess. Against the struggles against women's exclusion from various sectors of waged employment, to feminist struggles for reproductive autonomy and against patriarchal control at various sites of work and life, to the emergence of liberation movements for queer and trans people, and to shifting patterns of capital's investment towards historically feminized industries. But, as I will discuss in more detail later, the transformative potentials of mid-20th century struggles to remake gender and reproductive relations have partially been blocked by state co-optation and by the resistance of men, including those on the left and in the labor movement. If these two moments of class antagonism were conditioned by divergent historical transformations of gender and family forms, they also make manifest historical differences in the dynamics of class struggle and capital accumulation within some of the leading transit industries of 19th and 20th century capitalism, respectively. In part because of the railway industry's reliance upon lines of track rooted in the ground, the forms of intensive value extraction or speed up imposed after 1873 on signal operators, guards, and drivers were particularly dangerous. Avoiding new capital investment in track construction, railway owners simply ran trains more frequently on the lines, attempting to realize more value in the form of passenger and cargo receipts per labor hour. This led to a spike in fatal railway accidents in the early 1870s. By the 1890s, railway managers began investing in larger capacity engines and carriages, thus further increasing the organic composition of capital, which tended as well to increase the severity of accident-induced injuries. However, by the 1890s, companies had begun to invest in safety-promoting brake technologies as well, which tended to diminish the rates of accidents. While airline owners similarly responded to the 1970 crisis of profitability by attempting to realize more value per labor hour, in part by increasing the frequency of flights, the fact that planes passed through the air on their journeys between terminals meant that increases in the frequency of flights tended to have relatively little effect on accident rates, although air traffic controllers did report increasing rates of near misses following increases in the frequency of flights. Managers of individual airline firms determined that to realize profits, they needed to aggressively compete for passengers, particularly for businessmen who traveled frequently between major urban hubs, whom they tried to attract by normalizing sexual harassment against flight attendants on their airlines. The 1970 crisis of profitability in the airline industry was spurred in part by the adoption through the 1960s of higher capacity jet-powered planes. The introduction of jumbo jets not only contributed to a profit squeeze in the industry, but also exacerbated existing tensions between pilot and flight attendant organizers. Jumbo jets required more flight attendants than lower capacity planes, but did not require more pilots, meaning that the ratio of flight attendants to pilots within their combined unions began to significantly increase through the 1960s. Stewardesses' increasing numbers within airline workers' unions, as well as their rank and file mobilization against sexual harassment, was neither welcome nor supported by pilot unionists. The hostility of male pilots compelled flight attendants to form autonomous unions over the course of the 1970s. A similar dynamic played out at this time amongst airline traffic controllers, as male PATCO leaders refused to address rampant sexual harassment in the air traffic towers, prompting the formation of autonomous feminist organizations by women controllers, many of whom had either previously worked as flight attendants or had built relationships with stewardesses for women's rights and other flight attendant organizations. This history of sexist exclusion and disregard can help explain the signal defeat of PATCO's 1981 strike. The strike was broken in large part because no other sectors of airline workers engaged in sympathy strikes. Despite the fact that trade unionists from all airline sectors had raised concerns about issues of safety through the 1970s, and that issues of unsafety could perhaps have formed a basis for cross-sectoral solidarity, as they had on the 19th century railways, what various airline workers meant by unsafety and sought as remedies often diverged, and sometimes were perceived by other workers as threats to their position or prerogatives and were actively resisted. When controllers sought to limit pilots' room for discretion, they faced hostility from pilot unionists. And when women controllers and flight attendants challenged workplace sexual harassment, they received virtually no support and often open hostility from their male coworkers. Struggles against unsafety in the airline industry over the 1970s thus were characterized by a series of missed connections. Okay, that's the first section. I want to turn now to a consideration of some of Marx's writings on machine-driven production and on the real subsumption of labor to capital. In what follows, I hope to show how materialist interpretations of these texts in the 1970s pulled Marx's categories in somewhat new directions, and how these rewritings of Marx's concept of real subsumption were conditioned by some of the historical differences I've been exploring in my juxtaposition of railway struggles of the 19th century and airline struggles of the 20th. Okay, Marx fleshes out the concept of real subsumption in a series of manuscripts composed during the early 1860s, contrasting this concept with what he refers to as formal subsumption. For Marx, formal subsumption consists of the processes by which non-capitalist forms of production are brought under the control of those managing capital and made into engines of capital accumulation. When formally subsumed, the concrete quality of the labor process doesn't change. However, the mechanism by which workers are disciplined within this process does change. Rather than through more direct forms of coercion or social authority, those who labor are disciplined, according to Marx, largely by their need for monetary wages in order to survive. Real subsumption, on the other hand, involves fundamental transformations in the quality of labor processes. For Marx, the change characteristic of real subsumption is the introduction of large-scale machinery into production processes, which accelerates these processes and, in doing so, enables the ever more intensive production of value. Marx attempts to think through the various dynamics and effects of real subsumption in the manuscripts of the 1860s, as well as earlier in the Grundrisse and ultimately in the first volume of Capital. As he argues in these texts, the emergence of machine-centered production, enabled particularly by steam power, new mining practices, and railway technologies, does not simply change the quality of the labor process. Real subsumption also entails transformations in the social relationship of labor and capital, or new modes of labor's subjection to capital. In the Grundrisse, he writes, in machinery, knowledge appears as alien, external to the worker, and living labor as subsumed under self-activating, objectified labor. The worker appears as superfluous to the extent that his action is not determined by capital's requirements. For Marx, real subsumption exposes proletarian populations to superfluity and immiseration in a number of ways. First, by diminishing the socially general amount of time taken to produce a unit of value, real subsumption ensures that displaced, wageless populations won't be able, through small-scale production or other means, to accumulate what they need to survive. The value of their products, even if they work long hours, will be minimal. And second, within the labor process itself, waged workers' bodies and minds become expendable and exposed to harm, partly because the knowledge and motor force enabling the production process exists largely outside of and in opposition to them. Marx presents the factory system as a force that systematically breaks down workers' bodies, while at the same time exposing wageless, displaced populations to immiseration. In the manuscripts, he refers to both waged and unwaged proletarians as members of surplus populations, which suggests that Marx understood the condition of superfluity to cut across various sites, both waged and unwaged, of proletarian life. While Marx suggests that real subsumption puts in crisis the reproduction of proletarian populations, he nevertheless conceptualizes real subsumption relatively narrowly as the transformation of direct processes of value production, while leaving outside the frame both the effects these transformations have on social relations more generally, as well as what might be understood to be mutually determinative transformations in regimes of social reproduction or in other dimensions of social life. Marx generally brackets questions of social reproduction. As Marxist feminists have demonstrated, he systematically ignores the forms of indirectly waged reproductive and care labor, often performed by women, that enabled waged workers to return each day to their sites of employment. Marx's general disregard for reproductive and care labor distorts his theorization of waged labor processes as well, as he conceptualizes the concrete quality of industrial labor to consist more or less of overseeing the machine. This image of a kind of one-sided technical labor is belied insofar as railway, nursing, and other emergent forms of waged work in the late 19th century involved the management of consumers' affective experiences and bodies more generally, and insofar as industrial workers were disciplined in part through the activation of their concern for the bodily integrity of other workers. 19th century training manuals frequently stress that any deviation from company regulations could result in the injury of other workers or of passengers. Workers were not simply overseeing machinery. They were managing complex assemblages of bodies, materials, and machinery. Industrial labor thus took on an affective or reproductive dimension as early as the 19th century, a dimension perhaps obscured insofar as affective labor was interwoven with workers' oversight and use of complex machinery. By the mid-20th century, however, the affective or reproductive dimensions of various waged labor processes had become more salient, as jobs characterized primarily by work on others' affective experiences or bodily health came to be more common and more central to circuits of capital accumulation. This shift in the concrete quality of metropolitan labor processes, along with some of the other historical transformations discussed in the first section of this paper, conditioned late 20th century rereadings of Marx's writings on real subsumption. Whereas Marx had presented real subsumption as a process that rendered both waged and unwaged proletarian populations dependent upon and exposed to injury by machine-driven production processes, theorists of the 1960s and 70s offered accounts of real subsumption that stressed somewhat different shared proletarian experiences and sites of struggle. Theories of precarious labor, for example, emphasized the casualization of work, high rates of structural unemployment, and forms of material deprivation faced by proletarianized populations, but generally did not consider unsafe working conditions to contribute to labor's precarity. Italian autonomous notions of the social factory and the socialized worker, on the other hand, attempted to grasp the processes by which social life beyond the factories came to be regimented according to the temporalities of capital accumulation, and attempted to come to terms with shifts in labor processes that were making affective, conceptual, and reproductive activities more salient features of waged work. But again, as Silvia Federici has argued, prominent theoretical and historical engagements with these autonomous categories, particularly Hart and Negri's empire, generally have not attended to work performed in highly dangerous extractive industries, nor have such writings attended, except in passing, to the particular forms of unsafety, immiseration, and exploitation that women and racialized populations faced at the close of the post-war boom within and beyond waged workplaces. How much time do I have left in it? Not much.
Like 5 minutes.
Oh, okay, great, thanks. Okay, so by way of conclusion, and I'll probably have to skip over some of this, I want to offer a somewhat broader historical sketch of struggles along the edges of social reproduction from the 1950s through the 1970s in the U.S., in the United States, showing some of the ways that resistance to particular forms of race and gender oppression cut across sites of waged and unwaged work and provided openings for broad-based class struggle. Along with my earlier depiction of flight attendants' resistance to sexual harassment on the plains, this final historical sketch is meant to flesh out some of the dynamics and sites of class struggle that went missing in late 20th century rewritings of the categories of the category of real subsumption. I first want to consider the year-long 1956 bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, which was initially organized by members of the Women's Political Council. The boycott involved a collective refusal on the part of black women engaged in domestic labor in the homes of white people to commute to and from work on segregated municipal bus lines. As Paula Giddings writes, black women needed public vehicles to get to the white part of town to perform the numbing and exploitative work that had been their lot for centuries. They needed the vehicles to return home for precious and fleeting moments with their children before morning, when they had to ride them to work again. Ill treatment on public transport represented the final insult and humiliation to black women in a society run by white men. In her narrative of the origins of the boycott, Joanne Gibson Robinson describes a number of particular instances of harassment and violence faced by black passengers prior to the boycott, including times when bus drivers physically assaulted passengers and when drivers called the police against passengers who refused to give up their seats or who challenged the drivers in any way. In 1952, a man named Brooks was shot and killed by an officer after simply insisting, contrary to the white bus driver's accusation, that he had in fact paid his fare. The bus boycott in Montgomery set off cycles of struggle against racial apartheid in both the South and the North, including in the northern cities to which black proletarianized populations had been migrating, partially because of mechanization and other changes in agricultural labor processes that were expanding rates of rural unemployment. Neighborhoods into which black people were initially able to move were frequently targeted by municipal governments for demolition and urban redevelopment, and northern cities generally failed to establish decent schools or other public services in predominantly black neighborhoods. Through the 1960s, waves of riots, often sparked by acts of police brutality, contested these conditions in the cities. Great Society-funded storefront service organizations were established in the late 1960s in an attempt to channel and manage increasingly militant opposition to structural deprivation and exclusion, which these organizations attempted to do in part by leading campaigns for the expansion of access to social welfare benefits. As Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward show, however, this organizing had a tendency to exceed the limits envisioned by federal bureaucrats. They describe a 1967 sit-in at a Boston welfare department where police struck those sitting in, who cried out from the windows of the welfare department, and for 3 nights, widespread rioting erupted in the streets. So I was going to talk a little bit about the formation of like forms of autonomous reproduction through the Black Panther Party, the free breakfast programs in particular, and then also the Jane Abortion Collective in Chicago, but I don't think I have time to do that. But basically, sort of in both of those conversations, I was trying to talk also about ways that the state attempted to co-opt or neutralize the transformative potentials of those sort of movements. And then also to talk about, in a sort of similar vein, organizing against sexual and domestic violence, both in sites of and privatized sites of reproduction and in waged workplaces, so amongst clerical workers, and also the sort of emergence of the battered women's movement or the like shelter movement in the emergence of like radical women's shelters in the early 1970s, and then their kind of co-optation into state organizations. But yeah, so a lot of that. I guess I'll just sort of finish by saying, in discussing or mentioning the constellation of these struggles, I've tried to show how they emerged in part as responses to transformations in labor processes linked to structural crises of profitability. But I've also tried to show how they participated in genealogies of struggle against particular forms of racialized and gendered violence and control, forms of oppression that tended to reproduce hyper-exploitative regimes of social reproduction. In doing so, I've attempted to indicate ways that the category of real subsumption might be remade, but also have tried to fracture this category in pushing it past its limits.
Hi, my name is Zivka Wolewiczowska, and I'm working on the intersection between political theory and Soviet history, and I'm working on a project, a kind of an intellectual history of Marxist ideas in the 20th century Eastern Europe, which is a challenging and quite treacherous project. And here I'll be sort of presenting a piece of work on the 1970s. During which there's an explosion of Marxist humanist ideas after Stalin that the Marxist feminist movements contributed to. And so I'm hoping that this will contribute to sort of an imminent critique of social relations of post-Stalinist socialist societies. And we'll see what your feedback would be on that. It's a very preliminary sort of sketch. So I suppose that I'll be chiming in on some discussions around so-called socialist planning, a discussion that usually mobilizes the language of traditional political economy to map out the architecture of social relations of 20th century socialisms. Well, that language centers on and privileges the organization of labor and the means of production, distribution, circulation, market, liberalization, and so on. In this sense, public planning cannot and should not be opposed to capitalism. The argument continues. On the contrary, one can draw parallels and find uncanny similarities between the planned economies of the socialist states and the regimes of labor, production, and distribution of capitalist societies. From this perspective, the socialist economies appear as more or less failed, clumsy, unsuccessful variations of the interwar Western economies. We also heard some Marxist analysis from the 1980s and 1990s, which argue that 20th century East European societies retained the wage labor form as a general mediating form of social relations. And from this perspective, they not only failed to supersede capitalist relations, but have retained some of capitalism's central mechanisms of social domination and its most pervasive forms of social alienation. Thus, they've joined various discourses of failure that have dominated our understanding of the social makeup of 20th century socialist societies, implicitly endorsing Cold War ideologies of totalitarianism. Now, here I'm going to argue that all of these analyses have privileged a certain male-centered understanding of what constitutes productive labor and that they need to be subjected to feminist critique. First, they see the socialist economies as immutable, ahistorical, frozen in time, with no internal development or history, and that's very common. And second, the gender relation, which has historically been central to the question of social reproduction, remains extrinsic to the analysis of social relations. In this sense, they render invisible the question how the feminist movements after Stalin engaged the realm of social reproduction, radically changing the social composition of post-Stalinist societies. So rather than thinking about how the state regulated the family and all that from above, or how they intervened and controlled populations, we need to, which are really important questions, and I think they need to be answered over and over in new ways. But also we need to think about how the socialist state was gendered from the start, and how women's movements intervened on the level of social reproduction to reshape not only the state's mechanisms of social governance, but also the social meaning of the very social meaning of the state. And so here I'd like to offer a historical reconstruction of the feminist debates on women's emancipation that emerged in the 1970s. We'll see why the gender relation becomes a starting point for an imminent critique of social relations after Stalinism to reshape the field of social reproduction and the state's mechanisms of social governance. And not only that, these critiques shifted the discourses and political ideas around socialist freedom, autonomy, and personhood, and these ideas were put into motion to shift the very meaning of the state itself and to produce particular subjectivities. And so what is the logic of these subjectivities the question here is what is the very logic of these subjectivities that sort of engages the subject's sense of freedom and autonomy, and how do we understand the normative regulation of gender as it's tied to the socialist state's regimes of ownership and modes of production? So here I'm going to look at the theoretical work of two widely published and influential Marxist feminist thinkers from the 1970s, Svuda Pateva and Maria Dinkova, who worked in Bulgaria and were active in the international women's movement throughout the socialist countries in the 1970s. They began to study how gender relations were reconfigured after the first decades of socialist urbanization and industrialization. In a sense, they turned to the gender relation, into a critical lens through which they developed an imminent critique of what they called developing socialist relations under Stalin. They argued that the Stalinist project of gender equality was successful in unsettling the gendered logic of the division of labor and the gendered segregations of labor, especially in industry, also embraced an integrationist approach that had serious shortcomings. Stalinist policies, which continued up until the 1960s, incorporated women into the working class and into the factories, introducing affirmative quota systems, removing legal obstacles to social mobility and gender equality, and opening conditions for women's economic independence. In the words of Maria Dinkova, in the first few decades of building socialism, I'm quoting her, We transformed women's occupational duties by transferring women's labor from socially and economically disadvantaged fields, such as agriculture and crafts, to social and public institutions. We gave independent income and independent legal status to all working women, liberating them from economic dependence on their family and men. We created conditions for building a new social structure for working women. We removed all juridical limits to the professional and social realization of the woman. We created the conditions for women to acquire education so that she can participate in all spheres of social production, receive equal wage and for equal labor, combine professional labor with motherhood, and pursue her social interests in all spheres of public life and social governance. Yet, she continues, these policies did nothing more than integrate women into a modern architecture of production that remained designed around male-centered conceptions of time and productive labor. Their integrationist approach failed to engage and overcome the structural contradictions emerging from the segregated and antagonized spheres of production and social reproduction inherent in capitalist relations. As the surplus-driven logic of capitalist production both depends on, and renders invisible, the site of social reproduction. Women's work in the home and their reproductive labor becomes the crucial yet unaccounted for terrain upon which surplus value is generated. Thus, the structural conditions of modern capitalist industrial societies posit an irreconcilable contradiction within the woman subject burdened with the work of social reproduction. A structural split haunts the subjectivity of women, manifested in the multiple dilemmas and conflicts which she ought to navigate in her pursuit for self-realization. As Dinkova states, quote, in the final analysis, social progress or emancipation should be measured according to the individual's freedom to define her own intended role in social relations, and we need to expand the institutional, legal, and material conditions that can make this possible. A socialist feminist reform, they argued, would need to resolve the antagonism of production and social reproduction inherent in capitalist relations by embracing the historical and contemporary experiences of women as mothers, workers, and activists in public life. And Dinkova writes, another long quote just to give you an idea of the language, the traditional argument is that because of motherhood, the woman is unable to realize her professional and social capacities and aspirations. This is in 1971. But this is not the case. In fact, the opposite is actually true. By itself, motherhood does not impoverish but enriches the structure of social activity. Motherhood by itself does not exclude the possibility for the full participation of women in social life, but on the contrary, requires that social organization itself needs to be adapted to accommodate every new instance of the relationship between the production of the means of subsistence and the reproduction of humans, between immediate production and social reproduction, a relation which changes with every change in the forces of production. So the feminists were part of a Marxist humanist intellectual and political movements from the 1970s, as I mentioned at the beginning. They revived the concept of dialectical totality, which Stalinist Marxism had expelled from its conceptual apparatus. Not just to develop a critical analysis of social relations, but to define political categories of freedom and personhood. The socialist person in the post-Stalinist version of personhood was a holistically developed person who embodies a micro-universe of sorts through her purposive self-activity. Her social life integrates the fragmented and antagonized spheres of activity resulting from the division of labor under the industrial mode of production and restores the social whole. Abolishing dichotomies between public and private, the state and the social, between work and leisure, production and social reproduction, the socialist person will overcome the fragmented, reified subjectivities that capitalism produces. Svoboda Pateva, another prominent feminist thinker from the 1970s, argues, the ideal of socialist humanism is the dialectical totality of the laboring, political, and exuberant human. In other words, the harmoniously developed person who engages in creative activity in all aspects of human life, in labor, in public life, in science, culture, entertainment, and so on. Such dialectical totality is expressed both through the external products of social activity, the products of labor, public life, and relations with others, and through the subjective experience of the person herself. Now, a little bit on post-Stalinist dialectical humanism. East European humanisms in the 1970s came to overcome the Stalinist philosophical legacy. Stalinist Marxism-Leninism eliminates human agency from the understanding of historical development, turning ordinary humans into passive subjects with no historical agency. In other words, it is not the collective activity of humans, as it is certainly, and it is certainly not collective struggle that makes change possible. And you know, the masses figure as this passive unitary subject. The only active agent in history, as we know, remains the dominant party, whose legitimacy is grounded in the teleological narratives of the arrival of communism. It is not surprising that much of the efforts to overcome the legacy of Stalinist thought in Eastern Europe from 1956 onwards found it compelling to engage with the question of human agency. Post-Stalinist philosophy sought to restore the humanist aspects of both Marx's work and the bourgeois liberal traditions. Multiple left intellectual movements emerged during the socialist 60s and 70s. They called themselves revisionists, but they should not be confused with the early 20th century revisionisms of various sorts. And And the point is that their histories have remained largely suppressed under the monolithic category of totalitarianism. And so they recovered and published early works by Marx, formerly excluded from the canon, in order to come up with humanist concepts of social development and freedom. Socialist feminist ideas from the 1970s certainly fall into within this humanist tradition, and they also share some of the contradictory aspects of the Western socialist feminisms from the 1970s, which Donna Haraway has called both denaturing and naturalizing, denaturing as well as endorsing naturalizing discourses on female sexualities and bodies. We'll see some of this here, especially in the way Marxist feminists privileged epistemologically the historical experiences of women, which becomes, quoting Dinkova, the embodiment of an advanced character for the socialist way of life, the embodiment of a social practice in which every citizen meaning member of the community, feels responsible for everything and is capable of intervening directly in the solution of problems which are socially significant. What is historically specific to post-Stalinist humanist discourse is that it replaces the central Marxist category of labor with that of social activity and sometimes life activity. The category of class disappears to give way to the concept of youth, a concept aiming to capture a new heterogeneous collective subject that signifies a rupture with the past and unsettled structures of understanding confined to class relations. A normative concept of socialist personhood appears to mark the post-Stalinist shift from the analysis of objective material conditions to an emphasis on subject production. The structure of socialist time acquires very different conceptual dimensions. They insisted on humanizing the normative structure of time as multiple activities outside the traditional wage labor form acquire social visibility and social value. Dinkova argues that the activities in the sphere of family life belong to the reproduction of the human, and so do these activities related to, quote, the creation of conditions for her birth, upbringing and education, the organization of the material conditions for her physical needs in life, for her health, and for her recreational needs when she's not capable of what is commonly considered productive labor. Sociologists studied the person's time budget to make sure the socialist person has enough time for diverse, loosely defined activities, including time for public life, for family, for culture, arts, sports, leisure, recreation, for socializing and rest, including the working person's need for doing nothing in particular. In other words, a host of activities acquire social value. They become available to the socialist person. They open up more terrains for the socialist person's experience of autonomy and self-realization. The feminists also insisted on humanizing the instruments of labor, of redesigning the organization of labor and machinery so that it can accommodate the physical needs of women as workers and mothers. And last but not least, they argued that the new modalities of social governance should finally make it possible to abolish the state's apparatus of civil control and policing, as well as the army. And the next part of this project, which I'm not presenting here, is to show how these 1970s concept of freedom and socialist personhood were also, you know, like discourses of intense normalization. Three points of questions for further sort of development and research and analysis follow. The first one is these were discourses generally adopted by the state, but as you may have noticed, I've avoided using the word the state because my hope is to capture those subjectivities from the perspective of which the state remains invisible. Second, there's an incredibly interesting circular logic inscribed here as one theoretical essay from the 1980s argues the ultimate goal of socialist governance is the complete convergence between human self-realization and socialization. And so what are the sort of consequences of that totalizing reach of this totalizing discourse? And so I'm interested in the question how the realm of social reproduction becomes both a site for the articulation of freedom while it is also subjected to intense regulation as it gets folded into the logic of this circularity, totalizing circularity. And the third question is that these discourses by no means posited a homogeneous and unitary subject, but defined a heterogeneous field of activity that opened up possibilities for the articulation of multiple ambiguous and sort of non-identical subject positions that fracture the totalizing force of the state. For example, what does it mean to posit motherhood as a terrain of autonomy or freedom for women, but also to see freedom as freedom from motherhood at the same time? What kind of multiple non-identical woman subjects did this sort of non-unitary, non-singular prescription of freedom posit? And I'll just end here.
I'm Jacqueline Frost. And this is Marlo Longley.
I think the impulse toward this project for us came from some pretty big questions, but mostly a confusion regarding the call to abolish gender and basically sort of trying to articulate and disambiguate and gain some clarity around what that object gender is. So it's big questions, but...
Yeah, so we called the paper A Political Economy of Sex Work, and in a way we're gonna try to do something that's really different from what Zhivka and Amanda have done, which is to posit a struggle and then sort of draw conclusions from that. I think that we're sort of starting with an object maybe of struggle and then trying to draw out some conclusions in that way. So these are really, I think, different methods, but maybe complementary, I would hope. So there's a couple provisos to the paper, two, in fact, which are that this paper is conceived as a contribution to communization discourse, specifically, and its relationship to gender as a fixity of the capitalist totality, and that it accesses some Marxist feminist theories of gender from the 1970s, but it's not specific in that way. It's actually working through a lot of, I would say, like more contemporary from the last decade sort of theories of sex work in particular. And so what we're going to do is go through some of the communizationist approaches to gender, and then we're going to look at our object that we're pulling out of that, which is the erotic, and then we're going to move into sex work as a sort of like mechanism to run that on, I guess, is like a way to think of it. And then within this, the section on sex work, the proviso is that we don't really have any sort of account for the differentials between different races and classes in the way that sex work operates in experientially in that sense, but that we're just trying to draw out in the broadest sense what the erotic or fucking or however you want to put it, what that means and might mean under capitalism. Okay. Yeah. So we had this sort of like prolix introduction, which we're just going to skip for the sake of time. But we pulled out this quote from a text called Sonogram of Potentiality, which you might know. It was written by someone who was part of Tikkun and is now no longer. And you may or may not agree with it. I don't know if I necessarily agree totally, but it is like extremely provocative. So, quote, Engels could say all that he liked, that within the family, the woman is the proletariat and the man is the bourgeois. But his comparison comes up against a stumbling block in the fact that in society, the bourgeoisie gives no pleasure to the proletariat, and love and desire only mix in an oblique manner in their relations. And so I think that what we're trying to do is think about the dialectic between violence and pleasure and the way in which that might be the thing which is the thing which surpasses the sort of class relation, I guess, so that those things can't be mapped onto each other, which we know.
Okay, so now some brief context. It has been shown, I'm going to actually do this. It has been shown that gender is necessary to capitalism insofar as capitalism mobilizes a gendered division of labor resulting in separate spheres of activity. One sphere is social, that is waged, while the other is non-social and non-waged. Within capitalism, a separate sphere of labor is required to reproduce the waged worker, and this labor is generally done for free. It's being free as an incentive to the capitalist because the less paid in wages for the reproduction of the worker, the more surplus value can be extracted from labor power. So Théorie Communiste, which is a group that we utilize a lot in this paper, points out that domestic labor is women's labor by definition because it's performed by people who exist in a relation of dependence to the wage worker and as such are relegated to the home as a site of wage worker reproduction. It is because of this structural relation of dependence and relegation to the private spaces of reproductive work that the activity of the category women is excluded from the field of the social. The gender division of labor reproduces social relations between men and women, social and non-social spheres of work, and labor and capital. So another way to put this, in a way that TC does put it, is that capital rejects as non-social the moments of its own reproduction which escape direct submission to the market or to the formal processes of production. The private is the private of the public, always in a hierarchical relation of definition and submission to the public. So what does this rejection look like? What does this rejection of the non-social look like? We assert that it takes the dual form of violence toward and the eroticization of feminized subjects. It has been spuriously suggested that men and capitalists benefit from gendered violence only in terms of dominance, as if their goal was some sort of monopoly money that certifies superiority. Instead, sexual violence in capitalism is violence qua exploitation, not violence qua abstract social domination. But beyond the direct relationship of exploitation inherent in the social-non-social divide, the dynamic of gendered violence appears to have a separate set of criteria that does not originate in the contradiction between labor and capital. Its features then exceed a coextensive ontology. TC state, it is not in and for capital itself that the man-woman relation takes on a violent character. It is the a priori violent nature of that relation, which is its content, which mobilizes the extraction of surplus value. How then can we understand capitalism as giving a certain shape to gendered violence and oppression? And how does sexual labor, procreative or erotic, waged or unwaged, consistently construct genders in and for capitalism? So recently, communization feminists have attempted to answer this question. In a piece called The Gender Rift in Communization, the author P. Valentine proposes one material component of the gender distinction is violence. They write, it is impossible to accurately theorize the feminized sphere without referring to sexual violence, and so this represents a serious oversight in the existing theory. Valentine's perspective can help account for gender relations that fall outside man and woman, strictly speaking. It is because the social non-social determination does not inhere within bodies but shifts subjectivating bodies in endless configurations that patriarchy's grounding violence can be facilitated through anyone. Gendered violence, as well as erotic objectification, interpolates gay and queer men, trans people, gender nonconforming people and bodies, and children of any gender as feminized. And that's a quote from Valentine. So recognizing the essential fungibility of feminization is crucial for bringing this feature of transferability to bear on the gendering process. And another person who's really big in this discourse, Maya Gonzalez, has correctly stated in the piece Communization and the Abolition of Gender that women and men are not and never will be the same for capital. Women's work will always be women's work, even when waged. Gonzalez ultimately attributes this difference for capital to women's capacity for childbearing. Because of contingencies such as maternity leave or child emergencies, things like this, women are objectively less desirable workers in the sex-blind abstraction of the market, and therefore end up doing lower-wage and more precarious-wage work. Gonzalez is able to maintain a focus on childbearing while addressing deep structural concerns. Along these same lines, we uphold the necessity of a theory of gender that goes beyond the abstract wage of TC and grounds gender in realities that exceed the wage relation, a theory that can account for why gender still operates in a sex-blind market. The conclusions of sex and romance have historically been and continue to be marriage and childbearing. This historical tendency reveals the role of the erotic within the capitalist mode of production. We will be arguing that which is described by theses such as Maya's, like her kind of biological thesis, is often tinted by the erotic itself. Often reproduction itself is couched in erotic terms. So,
yeah, the way that I like to think about it is that you have this sort of procreative and erotic sort of columns or something like that, and that this is like the concept and how it's all like all working. I don't know if that's helpful. Okay, so this is going to be the section on eroticism, and then we're going to talk about sex work afterwards. So as Prabha Kodaswaran, who is a self-described post-colonial materialist feminist, who has a really brilliant book on sex work in India. It's really, really amazing. She says that feminist theorizing sex work hardly offer an elaborate normative theory of sex. And by normative, she means stable or legal, not normative. But many theories view sex work as an exception in that it is exceptionally violent or exploitative or degrading to women over and above other work that women and feminized people do. We believe these arguments are tacitly based on a precious conception of the female body as endowed with sacred content. This obfuscates the fact that sexual violence and eroticization occur in both the social and non-social spheres of activity and in all types of labor that constitute them. We dismiss sex work exceptionalism in order to take an exception with sex. Sex, waged or unwaged, has a specific content, which is the erotic. The gender relation, according to Marxist and more recently communizationist discourse, can be typified by an appropriation of labor that is concomitantly obfuscated as an act of will on the part of the feminized person. By this we mean that instead of coercion, there's also coercion, but instead of coercion, the exploitation at the heart of companionate coupling and family structures has the appearance of being done out of love, duty, or for romance. It is evidenced by the massive field of unwaged sexual labor that such exploitation occurs as a deftly sublimated theft of a person's activity. It is particularly ironic when sexual activity appears under the banner of love to be the only thing we actually own. But as queer theorists since the 70s have noted, no sexual practices up to this point have allowed us to dispense with subjects and objects. As such, no reformation of sex in itself can shift the gender distinction as it stands. To be masculinized is to act on others. To be feminized is to be acted through. The renegotiation of sexual mores, or a revised ostensibly egalitarian sexual ethic, despite its aspirations to liberate sex, always means a redefinition of what is private, which is TC. Moreover, it means a redefinition of the social and non-social divide, which will always entail the relegation of a category of feminized people to exploitation and the silence of bare life, which is Fulvia. We propose that recourse to beatings, bashings, rape, or molestation, as elaborated in P. Valentine's account, is not the only method used to secure the appropriation of labor. In cases when direct gain of domestic labor is not the purpose of violence, the effect of gendered violence may secure its own product, the masculinized subject necessary for the valorization of capital. Thus, if we are seeking to understand processes that gender subjects, we must begin to analyze relations that constitute the social non-social divide and are performed not just with complicity, but with a sense of self-determination and pleasure. We believe that the sphere of the erotic is unique because it is the sphere in which the exploited are structured to want it. So how literally can we take the social non-social distinction? The labor and activity of sex is non-social in the sense that it is predominantly unwaged. It is also non-social in the sense that it is literally out of sight, mostly. And therefore, so are certain bodies who perform such labor and activity. From here, we assert that sex itself exists in a hierarchical and submissive relation to all activities of the social sphere in the literal sense of being private, which is abstracted into the wage and therefore invisibilized. What we are calling invisibilization has in other contexts been called naturalization, but it confuses me, so I like invisibilization better. But if the social non-social dialectic is the content of gender, then the erotic is the content of the non-social. As Leopoldina Fortunati and others have remarked, women and other feminized people have always labored in both the waged and unwaged spheres. In the same sense, sex workers have also worked in formal markets and often in addition to their roles as mothers and houseworkers. In Fortunati's view, it is the mark of capital to exploit each of these positions simultaneously. It is perhaps from her analysis of domestic labor as productive of value that Fortunati comes to suggest that things like love, sex, and affection are commodities, where we might prefer use values. We are interested in Fortunati's claim that sex work does not formally exist as a commodity for capital. The formal non-existence of sex in the wage sphere is, in her analysis, capital's structural rejection of responsibility for directly reproducing the male worker sexually. Fortunati argues that because sex overwhelmingly exists outside the market, prostitutes appear to capital as an unnatural force of social labor. Sex workers then appear as unnatural or visible, sex workers then appear as the unnatural or visible exception to the rule of natural or invisible sexual labor. Their transgression involves a quantification of abstract domestic labor, which capital has rendered untenable. However, their form of labor is a transgression of the social and non-social divide that, by being an exception, dialectically reinforces the rule of free sexual labor. When the labor of feminized people cannot be entirely appropriated by men and capitalists or bought at the lowest possible price, it is culturally and legally sequestered to the realm of informal and criminal commodities. Insofar as certain races, classes, and castes are invisibilized, they are transformed into erotic objects. Though the torsions of race and gender are beyond the scope of our paper, sadly. Take such examples as the representation of migrant populations as trafficked sex slaves, the hypersexualization of black women, and the feminization of Asian men as phenomena that correspond to the twofold event we're defining as gendering, both the eroticization and the invisibilization. To augment TC's formulation that women are defined by capital as those on whom violence can be done, we contend that feminized beings are those through whose bodies the erotic is conducted, and that romantic desire does not preclude sexual violence as the sweeping phenomena of rape and abuse in companionate love relationships shows. We must conclude that pleasure and sexual violence are substantive of the same structure and both are required for the deployment of the other. Like capital, which abstracts and generalizes class oppression through the wage relation, gender abstracts and generalizes sexual violence and exploitation by reducing all of its features to eroticism sub silento, under silence. We have attempted to show that the erotic is not for nothing before we start talking about sex work. For this reason, communization will entail the abolition of gender to the extent that the erotic and the sphere of invisibilized and sexualized beings it constitutes is relentlessly dissolved. This disillusion will serve only as a preliminary negation that, if left incomplete, will appear in the form of an annexation of the social to the non-social, which we'll pick up. And we actually might not have a lot of time to talk about that, but yeah. So.
Okay, so this is a section on sex work itself. If sex work is the commodification of the erotic, then what is sex work? So as Kodeswaran notes, recognizing sex work as legitimate work is a preliminary step to a realist position on prostitution. However, we remain convinced that sex work, as one of many gendered labors, is particularly illuminating of gender production under capital. The contradictions drawn out by Fortunati, Singer, and others reveal that capitalism constructs a certain logic in terms of which sexual labor, reproductive and erotic, must also remain the only form of labor which is unpaid and uncompensated. Within the paradigm that regards compulsory heterosexuality in the family as key to capitalism, sex work appears to be the exception that proves the rule of non-social sex. Because of the intractability between the form, social, that is, waged, and the content, sexual, therefore non-social, of the sex work, it remains sub-social or lumpen. This presupposes that if it were to lose its criminal dimension through legalization or loss of stigma, it would enter the wage sphere proper, along with other formerly non-waged domestic work like house cleaning and childcare. This begs the question whether or not, if sex work were to enter the formal economy, whether or not it would be amongst the worst paid modes of employment, similar to these other previously non-waged domestic types of work. Some accounts of sex work see it as homologous with other service and leisure commodities. Elizabeth Bernstein's work on post-industrial sex markets has demonstrated that the proliferation of service work and the new global information economy was accompanied by a change in the family form with the rise of postmodern families peopled by isolable individuals. She claims that this shift in or dissolution of nuclear kinship formations produced a transformation in the erotic sphere, resulting in a recreational sexual ethic. This ethic is defined by emotionally bounded erotic exchange or bounded authenticity. Buying sex and erotic experience becomes more normalized for members of all classes in Bernstein's account. And thus in her account, sex bears no antagonism to commerce and becomes like any other leisure commodity on the market. Bernstein charts the changes in sexual markets as part of a general expansion of the service sector. So here we confront the same dilemma noted by Gonzalez, TC, and Valentine, that though women become waged workers, gender persists. For those who might assert that the shifting of the heterosexual nuclear family and the resulting freedom for women to enter the marketplace has any bearing on gender, the example of proliferating sex work provides a possible dismissal of this idea. The observation has a strange resonance with radical feminists who assert that prostitution makes gender worse, i.e. makes women on the whole more exploited, but really it is any entrance into the directly waged sphere that makes women more variously exploited, as Fortunati and TC try to elaborate with their work on women's part-time work. This annexation of women into the social does not undo gender. It serves simply to reinscribe, often more brutally, the social non-social distinction whose content is gender. So wage sex is a specific subset of sex in general. It relies on unwaged domestic sex for its very existence as a commodity. Free sex appears as the good or naturalized form of sex in relation to prostitution. In this way, sex work helps organize the persistence of unpaid sexual labor. As Kotaswaran elaborates, the deep structures of capitalism extend not merely to the fostering of sexual commerce and the expansion and diversification of sexual markets, but also its normalization through a dual logic distinguishing between commodified and uncommodified sex. So here, a commodity that maybe works with a similar logic functions as a parallel example. So the example is surrogate childbearing, which we think provides an interesting parallel to sex work in that its stigma and its like ambiguous status as a formal commodity interacts with the policing of the social non-social distinction. Surrogate motherhood consolidates free domestic childbearing in a similar way that sex work consolidates free sex. And here we see two types of waged work that require their unwaged instantiations. So there might be other types of work that follow the same logic, but we see resonances here that might be useful.
I think I just have a tiny thing to read, but stop here. I'll just read. We have other sort of like fluffier sections, but
We could stop.
Well, I'll just make one final point, which is that the culmination of thinking about an exception to the rule of non-directly waged sex is to sort of like bring about this understanding that you that by waging all of the domestic labors, you're not really getting rid of any sort of like gender division of labor, and that what that makes me think of essentially is the sort of like what I would say were mostly sort of like legal struggles around the legalization of prostitution or decriminalization, what have you, and the way in which bringing sex workers into the formally waged sphere is seen as sort of like a move toward a more just less exploitative, I guess, form of labor for sex workers. And I guess that's what I mean by the annexation of the social to the non-social, in the way that that has been shown in other forms of domestic labor not to do anything to gender. And so I'll just end by reading this tiny part, which is that the logic of annexation is embodied by proponents of the democratization of the social. Take as an example the struggles that I just mentioned. The annexation of the non-social to the social only serves to consolidate and stabilize the social and domesticate the features of the non-social, as long as both are only nominally so and retain ontologically distinct. So that's the thing. It's like, even if you formalize certain domestic labor, it doesn't change the fact that, like, women do it for some reason. Only an interpenetration of the non-social and the social, which in my opinion will take the form of a violent expropriation of the social by feminized people, which will encourage its dissolution, is really the only methodology with which to approach some sort of like struggle for feminized people. And therefore, the struggle of the feminized when victorious will necessarily undo the premise of reproducing the social itself, and therefore will entail a total dilapidation of those things. And so any communizing measures against gender must not simply use that annexation logic, but conceive of a radical collapse of both spheres.